Disc 7. Govinda was planning to talk to the group first, and I leave plenty of time for that. He promised to explain my return engagement in a very low-key way, not talking about the book or using any words like enlightenment or master, just saying I'm a special guest some of them might remember. The plan is that I'll participate in the discussion, not address the group like a speaker. Curtis and I enter quietly and find everyone meditating. We stand silently in the doorway, and I look around to see who I recognize. They must have activated their satsang phone tree or something, because tonight's crowd is more of the New Age variety than the Gita group I saw in the basement. This time, I wasn't going to wait for the coffee can. I gave Govinda some money a week ago and told him to set up a better space with better snacks. He did as I requested and rented the nicer upstairs meeting room with plenty of seating, large windows on two walls, high ceilings, adequate lighting, and not permeated with damp tobacco stench. There's also a much better assortment of snacks, including, but not limited to, butter-free cookies. There are two coffee urns, decaf and regular, and real cream. I'm glad to see everything upscaled a bit. Maom said that the thing about asking for the best is that she'll most likely get it, which is practically the golden rule of dream state manifestation. Ask and ye shall receive. This room may not qualify as the best, but it's a step in the right direction. Meditation concludes and everyone slowly unfolds out of it. People stand and greet each other, fill cups and plates, chat. Wheelchair-bound Barry is here, and several others I recognize from the last time, including Curtis's nuzzling co-ed, Rohan, the ringer, and a few others. Mark from the PR firm is here with his wife. The chairs were arranged facing a podium, but now everyone forms smaller groups, and everything gets shuffled around. I grab a seat with Mark and half a dozen others and listen quietly to their discussion. After a few minutes, Mark turns the conversation to me, and for the next 10 minutes we talk about some of the points made in Damnedest. The other little groups kind of gravitate toward our conversation until we all coalesce into a single, though somewhat disarrayed, group. I don't really want to sit around talking about the book. The original plan with Govinda was not to even mention it. After the third or fourth question about it, I quietly make the point that only a few people present have read it, so we should probably find a subject of broader interest. Megan, though, doesn't want to let it go. "I'm one of the few people here who's read it," she said, "and I've already shared some of my views with you in private. I was wondering if you could explain to us why you think people should buy your book." Yuck. Just the thing I'd hoped to avoid. Right out of the gate, we're in a marketplace mentality. I'm depicted as someone who is here to serve his own greed or vanity, and they're the skeptical consumers, wondering whether they should buy into my little fantasy. Megan has put me in this corner, and now I have to gently but firmly get out of it. "I don't think anyone here even knew there was a book," I reply. I look around, and it's clear that most of them didn't know. As to why anyone should buy it, I have no feelings on the matter. You were in a business meeting with me where we discussed the promotion of the book. Did I seem like someone who was eager to sell books? You were the one that talked about creating a bestseller. Did I seem to have any interest in all that? No, I have to admit, it was your suggestion that we establish the Jed McKenna brand, which would be good from a business standpoint. Have I mentioned the book here? Am I displaying a copy? She shakes her head. I don't want to pick on her, but I really can't have this thing go in the direction she set. Mark, you were at the meeting. What do you think of me as a book promoter?" "You're a publicity consultant's nightmare," he replies, and people laugh. "Govinda, did I..." "Thomas," he corrects me. "Oh, did I miss something?" "Before you came in, I spoke to the group and let them know that I was going back to my real name." I admire his decision. He's putting away childish things. "Thomas, did I arrange this event?"
"Nope."
"Was I eager to come?" He laughs. "Practically had to drag you. A lot of these people know you and trust you. Do you believe I'm here to sell something or convince anyone of anything? Do you think I have any motivation like that?"
"No, I'm sure you don't."
Megan jumps in. "I don't think it's fair of you," she says, starting to feel attacked and getting defensive, so I head that off.
"Wait, Megan, it's all right," I say, smiling and holding up my hands in a non-confrontational gesture. "We're not at odds here. No one's angry or defensive. I like you and respect you. I appreciate your contribution. I just wanted to make that point. You make me sound like I'm here to force myself down people's throats, and I'm just making the point that I'm not. I don't have any agenda here. We're just people sitting around talking together. You told me we're all in it together, right, Megan? So let's proceed on that basis. Here we are on this planet, somewhere in Queens, New York, USA, sometime in the 21st century, right? We're all in the same boat, floating on the same ocean, trying to make some sense of it all. Nobody's selling anything or running for office, right?" She laughs and smiles. "All right," she says. "Actually, I read around a dozen New Age titles a month because of my job, and yours was really refreshing. You're just like you seem in your book, by the way. Very open, very plain-spoken, a lot of common sense, no frills. That's what I really liked about your book, the common-sense approach. You make it all sound so, I don't know, obvious. And if you think about it, I suppose it is. I guess I made it pretty clear earlier that I don't agree with your conclusions, or maybe I just don't want to. But my sense when reading your book and talking to you now is that there's no, I don't know how to say it, there's no room for, you don't leave any room to maneuver, I guess. Maybe that says something about the straightforwardness of your approach, the simplicity of it. That was my reaction anyway. In Damnedest, I said that the only real spiritual teaching is think for yourself and figure out what's true. And that's what I'm saying here. I mean, seriously, what else is there to say? If you want it, it's yours. If you don't, whatever. I've really only got this one message, this one point to make. Pretty much anything else I say is either about process or negation. I don't engage in discussions in the conventional sense of a two-way exchange of knowledge and ideas. I don't take part in spirited debate or lively give and take. I don't entertain differing views, and they don't entertain me. Megan was right about me. I'm extremely narrow-minded. My state is one of being, not of knowledge or belief, and no force of emotion, strength of conviction, or weight of opinion can influence me in the least. So, yes, I seem arrogant, but that's just the appearance. There's no sense of superiority on my part. Can't be. Calling me arrogant is anthropomorphic. Am I pro-truth? No. Do I hate delusion? No. Do I consider the dream state evil? No. I'm not opposed to all the teachers and teachings that keep us so effectively narcotized. I don't think anyone or anything is other than perfect.
I'm not a warrior for truth. I'm not at war with the armies of the lie. I like the lie. I'm all for it. Maya and her magnificent palace of delusion have no greater fan than I. Having myself escaped from the confines of delusion, I'm able to appreciate its strengths and its vulnerabilities. Its greatest vulnerability is that it has no mass, no substance. There is no it, and all you have to do to see that for yourself is look for yourself. Its greatest strength is that looking for yourself is the last thing anyone, say what they may, really wants to do. Whatever that is, whatever happens to smash your life to bits, you will someday look back on with the profoundest gratitude. You will look back on it like a birth from the womb. The womb is lovely and insular and safe, but it isn't life. The distance between the womb and life may appear to be a few inches, but it's really the difference between two different orders of being. It's easy to see people as children, but it might be more useful to say they are unborn. They live unborn and often die unborn. When Thoreau said the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation, this is what he was talking about. There's the part of you that wants to be agitated, to bust things up and see what they're really made of. And there's the part that keeps that part swallowed down. Fear. Fear of losing what you have, but you don't really have anything. That's what the little voice is telling you. Nothing is yours, and nothing you do matters. That's the problem with the agitator. He never lies. He never exaggerates. He always makes perfect sense. He's a rational little bastard, so the only way to deal with him is to drown him out. Denial, says Megan. Denial, sure. But how does that work? Denial is just a label, and labels are themselves a tool of denial, allowing us to dismiss difficult things unprocessed, based on the name of the thing and not the thing itself. There are many tools of denial. Avoidance is popular, just keeping yourself constantly distracted so that there's no quiet time during which the little bastard's voice can be heard over the din. Belief is a good one because it's emotionally charged, and emotional nonsense drowns out rational sense. There are many ways in which ego keeps us from seeing the obvious. But what about society? Megan asks. What would the future look like if everyone listened to their, little bastard and unleashed their deepest, darkest selves onto the world? I don't know. Why ask me? Find the little bastard inside you and ask him. He knows. Okay, but right now I'm asking you. I don't know. Sounds messy. Could be bad. Maybe everybody would die. Where would we be then? What did yours say? My? Your little bastard. Ah. He said there is no society. There is no future. There is no world. Stop being a schmuck. It's all a lie. Burn it all. And that's something you did? Yes, ma'am. Why? For the only possible reason why anyone would ever do it. Because I absolutely, positively couldn't not do it. Do you have any regrets? She asks. It can be tricky knowing how much answer to give. This doesn't seem like the time to get into a long-winded digression about how I don't possess the thing that experiences regret. So I opt for the short answer. Nope. Chapter 26. Jolly Punches. There are certain queer times and occasions in this strange, mixed affair we call life when a man takes this whole universe for a vast practical joke, though the wit thereof he but dimly discerns, and more than suspects that the joke is at nobody's expense but his own. However, nothing dispirits, and nothing seems worthwhile disputing. He bolts down all events, all creeds and beliefs and persuasions, all hard things visible and invisible, never mind how knobby, as an ostrich of potent digestion gobbles down bullets and gun flints. And as for small difficulties and worryings, prospects of sudden disaster, peril of life and limb, all these, and death itself, seem to him only sly, good-natured hits and jolly punches in the side bestowed by the unseen and unaccountable old joker. That odd sort of wayward mood I am speaking of comes over a man only in some time of extreme tribulation. It comes in the very midst of his earnestness, so that what just before might have seemed to him a thing most momentous now seems but a part of the general joke. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Barry, the guy I sat next to during my first visit here, the subterranean meeting, has gestured me over to him. I take a seat, and a few others seated nearby turn to hear our discussion. "I'm wondering if you can help me," Barry begins. "I have a friend who's in a state of terrible depression. I'm very worried about her." Whether he has this friend or he's speaking about himself as a female friend doesn't matter to me. But as the conversation progresses, I come to think she's real. "She's very unhappy. She's just been getting worse and worse for the last few years, and I really think she's on the verge of doing something desperate. I don't know what to do for her." "What's the general nature of her unhappiness?" I ask. "What does she say it stems from?" "She hasn't said anything in particular. I mean, she doesn't have some disease or something. She hasn't lost a loved one or anything like that." Not all black despair is created equal. If the depression is the direct result of some disease or defect, meaning that the person is not clear thinking, then my response might be similar, but less optimistic, because it would seem that the friend was buckled in for her ride and must ride it until the end. This is just my opinion, no more authoritative than anyone else's, but it seems clear to me that there are many rides in this park. It's not all about the fun ones, and you can't get off until the ride comes to a complete stop. So much for free will. You can jump out midway, but whatever made you get aboard in the first place will probably make you get aboard again. Anyone wishing to confront the issue of free will versus predetermination should begin, as always, by bringing the question into sharper focus. There is no possibility at all of free will. Simply by defining it, we are able to see it as nonsense. So the real question is, do we have any will? Can we choose to exert or not exert any influence over anything? Do we possess the least tiny modicum of control? Any will or no will? That is the question. The only argument for the latter is that there's no argument for the former. Ultimately, no answer is possible, and the question itself disintegrates under scrutiny. All questions do. Everything disintegrates under scrutiny. The thing to be hoped for regarding Barry's friend is that she's in a rational depression. This is something we touched upon in Damnedest. When someone is without hope because they see that there is no cause for hope, there's hope. A question occurs to me. "Where does she live?" I ask Barry. "Brooklyn," he says grimly. "We don't see each other much. She doesn't get around so good. We mostly email and talk on the phone." I wonder if she's in a wheelchair, like Barry. I guess if you don't get around so good, Brooklyn and Queens can be worlds apart.
Is she intelligent? I ask.
Very.
Christian?
Yeah.
Catholic?
Oh. I would normally expect someone in this situation of prolonged despondency to eventually crash and burn, and then phoenix up out of the ashes. Christianity is generally conducive to this death, rebirth, transformation, but Catholics, in my experience, even lapsed Catholics, seem more likely to get stuck in the despair part and stay there. Rational depression isn't a defect or a disease. It's a perfectly appropriate response to the circumstances we find ourselves in. We have no future, no substance, and no significance. What's not to be depressed about? This isn't deep, soul-searching, high-minded stuff. A full and accurate accounting of one's life could be done over a cup of coffee or during a commercial break. From a logical standpoint, the only compelling argument against suicide is that failure may result in a $1,000 fine and 6 months in prison. Some people have found a personal savior, but the trick with saviors is not to look too closely. They've got you, but who's got them? Even the best long-term solution you can imagine, whatever you call heaven, starts to sound pretty dumb if you think about it for, like, 2 minutes. The trick is to not think about stuff, to not look for ourselves, to not see the obvious. But we can't trick ourselves forever, as Barry's friend is finding out. Depression is fear with hope removed. It arises as we discover that something we thought could be ours will never be ours. Unhappiness is when we worry about not having something. Depression is when we realize we'll never have it. And freedom is when we realize that nothing is ours and nothing can be ours, so that, in effect, nothing isn't ours. Our own lives are not our own, so what is?
Well, I say to Barry, I obviously can't speak with any authority about your friend in particular, but it sounds like something that I can talk about in general. This is going to come off as a bit heartless, probably because it is, but what might be the case with your friend, and anyone else who seems about to succumb to morbid despair, is actually the onset of human adulthood.
Oh, says Barry glumly. This isn't an Enlightenment thing in particular. It's more a human thing, but it certainly has parallels to the larger awakening process, and it's a precursor to Enlightenment, a prerequisite.
I don't know what to do about it, says Barry. I don't know how to help her.
Did you ever consider the possibility she doesn't need help? That it might be a good thing? I ask.
What? He says. Suicidal despair?
I laugh, but gently, because I know this is one of those areas where emotions can get fired up and scorch what could and should be an interesting discussion.
Well, kind of, I say. The despair is just the outer manifestation, the visible symptom.
When I see someone in the condition Barry describes, my first impulse is to congratulate them. I don't do it, of course. I understand that it wouldn't be received in the spirit intended. But I see it as a very positive thing growth-wise, human adventure-wise. That despair is most often a sign that one is breaking away from the fairy tale version of life, where good little boys and girls live happily ever after and moving into adulthood.
I'm worried she's going to die, he says.
I shrug. People may not want to play by the rules, but they're still the rules. One of the rules is that you die. We have one inalienable right, and that's it.
She's so unhappy, murmurs Barry.
Happiness is for children. There's another level, I reply. When we come to the point where we can't find any more happiness, and it looks pretty certain that we never will, we think it's all over. And, in a way, it is. In a good way. I'm really worried that she won't survive it.
Yeah, well, she might not,
I say with deliberate callousness.
That's a very clinical point of view, Barry protests.
This is a real person we're talking about. I don't think you understand. I hold up my hands to stop him.
Barry, don't take this too much the wrong way, but you're looking at this like she needs rescuing and that you must save her.
I understand that, but I've been through the process we're talking about, and you haven't. You're seeing a terrible crisis where I'm seeing normal human development.
Yes, it's painful, and it's difficult to watch.
You see someone sinking, and you want to leap in and save her.
I understand that she's resisting the process. I understand that she's flailing and crying for help. I understand that it's agonizing to watch.
I understand that you'd both like to go back to the way things were, to some happier time.
But that's no longer an option, is it?
He begins to react. The other people gathered around us are hushed. Curtis looks nervous. This is very personal for everyone. This is life stuff, and we're all in life.
Barry starts getting choked up and pleading that his friend's case somehow transcends the trite little spiritual bow I'm trying to tie around it. He's getting angry and offended, which is good. Polite facades aren't of much use here.
As Barry goes off on a small, barely controlled tirade against my callous indifference, I look around the small group to see how others are reacting. They all seem very present. They're not watching someone else's thing. They're seeing themselves and their own lives in this discussion. They don't look happy, but I am. This is life's wake-up call. Misery, suffering, loss, death. This is where people are forced to get real and where understanding can occur. They think I can help, and maybe I can, but not the way they think. I'm not a counselor or a mentor. I'm not interested in helping anyone feel better. I'm no one's friend. I dwell in an infinite, pitiless void. Or to state it more accurately, I am an infinite, pitiless void. That's my reality. I'm not a nice guy. I just play one. People sometimes come to me, as Barry is doing now, to show me something that they say is wrong and needs fixing. I am immediately in conflict with such a person. I do not and cannot share the view that something is wrong and needs fixing. No matter how absolutely certain someone might be that something is wrong, and no matter how terribly wrong it may appear, I am absolutely, unshakably certain it's not. I am incapable of perceiving error. I reside in a perfect universe where nothing can ever be wrong. We all do. I just happen to know it. When I speak or write, I'm not trying to convince anyone or sell anything. My whole gig is telling people to look for themselves, to simply see what's right in front of them. As Da Vinci said, some see when shown, and some don't see. I don't offer the old smooth prizes, said Whitman, but rough new prizes. These are the days that must happen to you. I'm sitting in a theater watching a film called Humanity. I look upon Civil War hospitals and Nazi death camps and children's burn wards with the same eye with which I look upon bursting gardens and star-swept nights and laughing babies. They're just the opposite poles of the film's emotional spectrum. They don't make me forget my reality. Nothing is so grotesquely horrible or so heart-wrenchingly beautiful that it transcends my transcendence. Nothing trumps truth. I know what man is, and I know what life is. If you look at these statements and decide, I'm a bad guy, then you're shortchanging yourself. You're mistaken in your belief that you're reading a dialogue between Jed and Barry, just like this Gita group was mistaken in thinking they were reading a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna. You, the reader, are at the exact center of the universe, your universe. It's all yours. It's all about you, and you are all alone in it. Anything that tells you otherwise is a belief, and no belief is true. Who is Krishna in the Gita? He's the perfect warrior compared to Arjuna's merely great warrior. The truth of self compared to false self. Arjuna is mighty, but he can still be bested. Not so Krishna. The perfect warrior is untouchable and unsurvivable. No sword can touch him, and nothing can endure the touch of his. The Gita is the dialogue between the false self and the true state, the bridging of the paradigm gap. To say that Krishna is God is to completely miss the real point of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is the truth. Arjuna is the untruth. The prize to be won in this battle is not wealth or fame or power, but the transition from untrue to true, from dream to awake, from delusion to reality. Truth is beyond opposites. Duality is a dream. It's not a yin-yang relationship. It's one or the other. The truth contains no element of the false, and the false contains no truth. There is only truth and illusion, and within illusion there is only fear and denial. Fear of truth is the foundation upon which Maya's palace of delusion is erected. She has no power but that we give her. Denial of fear is the motivation underlying all activities in which humans engage. This is vanity in the biblical sense. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. We must constantly project the illusion of self, because if we don't, we aren't. Barry is both pleading and angry. This is a real person I'm talking about. I come to you to ask how I can help her. I want to know what I can do for her. She's not a piece on a chessboard, you know. She's not a number. She's not a... Stop, I say. He doesn't stop. You can't just minimize people to make them fit your... Please stop, I say. He doesn't stop. Cold philosophical view of people like they're just... I let him go on for a minute until he's got it all out. When he's done, I proceed. You're viewing this from a warm, fuzzy place, Barry, I say gently, like somehow everything's going to be all right. But is it? I'm asking you now. Is it possible that everything's going to be all right? I wait for him to see it for himself. He doesn't speak. This is a harsh piece of business we're discussing, Barry. You won't solve it on this level. You have to step up to the next one. That's where it's going, with or without you. You want your friend back the way she was, but that's not one of the possible outcomes here. Denial is only a temporary refuge. It's gone past greeting card sentimentality. You see that, don't you? He stares at me for a moment, then exhales tremblingly and nods. Fear, I say. It's all about fear. Your fear, her fear. She's afraid, so she keeps struggling to stay afloat. You're afraid of losing her, so you keep encouraging her to struggle. Don't you ever get tired of being afraid? of struggling.
Barry doesn't reply. No one moves. The answer is to stop struggling, to go into the fear. Let her go. The cause of the unhappiness isn't the situation, but the resistance. You're making disease and decay and death evil, but they're not evil. They just are. The clinging is the cause of the unhappiness. Release is the answer. Let her sink. Barry lets that sink in for a moment. So what do you think I should do? I don't know. Send her a book about suicide. She's a Catholic. Not for long. But she's my friend. She'd hate me. She'd never speak to me again. Yeah, well, what are friends for? This gets me a dirty look, but I'm trying to provoke him. Listen, Barry. In a few minutes, I'm going to stand up and talk about a woman who was in a similar situation. Stick around and see if that gives you a better idea of what's really going on with someone at this stage, in this sort of crisis, okay? Barry nods. Someone rubs his shoulder comfortingly. Chapter 27. The Mind of Absolute Trust. In the world of things as they are, there is no self, no non-self. If you want to describe its essence, the best you can say is not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, and nothing in the world is excluded. The enlightened of all times and places have entered into this truth. In it there is no gain or loss. One instant is 10,000 years. There is no here, no there. Infinity is right before your eyes. One is all. All are one. When you realize this, what reason for holiness or wisdom? The mind of absolute trust is beyond all thought, all striving, is perfectly at peace. For in it there is no yesterday, no today, no tomorrow. Sing San. Chapter 28. Working Class Heroes. He knows himself and all that's in him who knows adversity. To scale great heights, we must come out of lowermost depths. The way to heaven is through hell. We need fiery baptisms in the fiercest flames of our own bosoms. We must feel our hearts hot, hissing in us. And ere their fire is revealed, it must burn its way out of us, though it consume us and itself. Herman Melville, Marty. There's a white marker board on wheels against a nearby wall, so I roll it out and use the black marker to draw a line from edge to edge. The line starts off level, then angles downward, eventually becoming a straight, vertical plummet. From the bottom of the plummet, it begins to rise again at a steep angle to a point where it shifts to a more gradual ascent. I end the line with an arrow to indicate that it continues. Flat, decline, plummet, steep ascent, gradual, ongoing ascent. I write Hero's Journey across the top of the board. I write Oblivious along the flat line at the beginning. Along the gradually descending line, I write Mass of Men. Along the vertically descending line, I write Event. Along the steeply ascending line, I write Rebirth. And along the less steep line, I write Life. I bisect the line vertically at the event point with a dotted line and write Flesh on the left side and Spirit on the right. I'm drawing the diagram as an aid to my own thinking, and so I'm ready in case tonight's meeting ever gets underway. But when I turn around, I find that everyone is now seated and facing me. I guess tonight's meeting is underway. Oh, I say. Hello, many of them reply cheerily. Huh, well, okay. I guess I'm going to stand up here and talk for a while about something I think is interesting. You know, in the hope that you'll think it's interesting, too. The startled, awkward part over, I proceed with the talking part. In the last several weeks, I've been surprised several times to see the ways in which we distance ourselves from our own lives, from life. I'll share a few of them with you. A friend of mine is a lifelong Melville scholar, but for some reason she's never drawn any connection between his works, most notably Moby Dick, and her own life. She somehow maintained an impersonal detachment. Then my friend Curtis here, I point him out, tells me he did a very interesting paper on the first Star Wars movie in terms of Joseph Campbell's description of the hero's journey. But when I asked him about what he'd learned about his own life in the process, he came up empty. Is that fair to say? I ask Curtis. He nods. Then, through a bizarre set of circumstances, I attend one of your meetings here. And there it was again. This funny way we have of reducing vivid illustrations of life's full potential to sterile intellectual models that somehow don't apply to us. Obviously, this is one of ego's many defense mechanisms. For those of you who weren't privileged to observe my performance here last month, a few chuckles, I pointed out the same thing I'm going to discuss tonight, that life isn't a spectator sport, that each of us is in it as much as anyone has ever been, that stories like Star Wars and the Bhagavad Gita aren't someone else's stories, they're our stories, that we are our own heroes, the heroes of our own lives. That is what the universe, in its not-so-subtle way, has suggested I talk about tonight. Sound okay? Everyone sort of smiles and nods, but they're all paying attention. I think one of the reasons for this artificial distancing is the godlike quality of the people we see as heroes and the mythic dimensions of their journeys. The best examples of this are men like Jesus and Buddha, who have been caricaturized like comic book heroes, far removed from anything a regular person could ever dream of becoming. In a similar vein, Star Wars is a fight for galactic peace, and the Bhagavad Gita takes place between two massive armies ready to attack. Probably none of us are thinking of going out after this meeting to find the Holy Grail or destroy the Ring of Power. I think this quality of grand proportions serves to take the hero's journey out of human scale and make it something Olympian, beyond the reach of mere mortals. Even when it's a common Joe, as in Joe versus the Volcano or the Wizard of Oz, it still seems like the stuff of imagination and fairy tales, not real life. So, what I'd like to try to do now is bring the whole thing back down to a size we can work with, so we can see who the real hero is and what the real journey is. Blank stares. People attentive, waiting. This is unusual for me. I can count on one hand the number of times I've addressed a group of people I didn't know. I can count on one finger the number of times I've used a diagram. Let me describe this diagram on the board. Then I'd like to read a letter I brought with me and see how this woman's journey compares to those of the great myths and legends. I turn to the board and indicate the flat beginning line marked Oblivious. We don't have to worry about this part too much.
We were all there, and we know many people who still are. But we're not anthropologists, so we'll just say that this is where the unquestioning dwell. Why they're unquestioning doesn't concern us, okay? No one says it's not okay, so I continue. This next part, marked massive men, is just that. This is where most everybody is. This is the line that you could isolate as its own spectrum of awakeness and place yourselves and virtually everyone you know along it somewhere. I marked it massive men because of Thoreau's statement. The massive men lead lives of quiet desperation. This is that. Before anyone chimes in, let me say that this isn't bad or negative or evil or anything like that. This is a part of life, a stage of growth, of normal development. Okay so far? It's not necessary to totally understand or agree with everything now. We'll come back to all this when I read the letter. No one chimes in, so I go on. Here's where it gets good, I say, circling the point at which the downward slanting line turns straight down and where the dotted vertical line divides the board into flesh and spirit. This is where real life begins, where we get into our true potential. This causes some stirring and grumbles, but we could get stuck here all night if I don't forge on, so I do. I've marked one side flesh and one side spirit, because this is where that transition occurs. Death of the flesh, birth of the spirit. Human childhood on the left, human adulthood on the right. This is where the small, segregated being ends and the boundless, integrated being is born. Death and rebirth. Several people raise their hands. Hold on, please. I know you have things to say. We'll get to everything. This is just the establishing shot, like a map we'll be referring back to. Just observe for now. I should point out that this isn't my little pet theory. This is the human map. It's not Eastern or Western or Christian or Hindu. It's human. And you'll find it wherever you find people. That might be my main point, that it's not really the hero's journey at all. It's the human journey. They're contained, but barely. So I finish the diagram quickly by saying that the steep ascent is the infancy and childhood of the newborn being, and that the more gradual upward line is the life of development and discovery. Any questions, just in general, about the diagram? A woman in her mid-30s speaks up. You say we're all on that mass of men part, but how do you know that? Maybe there are people here who have made that event transition. Sure, that's possible, I say. Anyone? No one. You're right, though. There could have been someone like that here. I assume there wasn't, because this is a group of seekers, and such a person would be in a different mode. Growth, exploration, development, expansion, something like that. Probably not worried about the lessons of the Bhagavad Gita. Okay? She smiles and nods. I take out the letter I'm carrying and unfold it. It's a mess from being in my pocket and from me scribbling notes all over it, crossing out whole sections and circling or underlying others. It started as 8 pages, but I've reduced it to a handful of phrases and paragraphs for the purposes of this discussion. Okay, so I have this letter, I tell the group. It came to me. I look at Curtis. How? Sonea forwarded it with other stuff. I don't know where she got it. Okay, so it's a mystery letter. It's from a woman named Jessica, who lives in Austin, Texas, addressed to me, and without her being particularly aware of it, it details her progress along this line I've drawn on the board. Let me give you some of the broad strokes. She's from a large rural family
from which she's the first to attend college. Paid her own way. Graduated and went to graduate school. Graduated and entered the workforce in the health field. We won't worry too much about her experience on the flatline, the oblivious period. What we learn from her letter, I'm scanning the opening paragraphs as I speak, is that after all the struggle to break out of her humble beginnings, after working her way through college and graduate school, after beginning on her career path, she was suddenly overwhelmed by the, I search for the phrase she uses, inauthenticity of it all. Let me quote a few parts. Here she refers to herself as lost and bewildered. She says she's lost all direction in life. I don't think that's too uncommon. She says that she realized her life and her success was just a facade, that everything she's been working for and everything she accomplished was false and illusory. The bottom dropped out from under my whole world, she says. See what she's saying about her experience at this stage? She's in a slide, and there's nothing to do, nothing to grab hold of, nothing to cling to. She can no longer hold the black cloud at bay, can no longer deny its blackness. She's in it now, enveloped by it. That's the process. That's what's happening. Nothing has meaning, and she can no longer pretend otherwise. It takes time. It's a transition, but this is what it is, the end of denial. No one looks very happy to hear this. One of the key elements of denial is denying that you're in denial. But these folks all made the effort to get here tonight, so I'm assuming they're wanting to look at this stuff. The point is, that's where everybody really is, living with some degree of doubt and fear and denial. How can you not be? It's not a matter of shame or inadequacy. It's just a matter of living in the dark. You see how this mass of men line angles down? That's where gravity is taking us. This is where life naturally goes. Yet we spend our lives fighting against it, fighting against life. Instead of going along and trusting, we throw all our might into resisting. Why? Because we're afraid of what's down there. Change, disruption, the unknown. It's all about denial and resistance. I indicate the building we're all in. What else is religion but man's fortress against reality? Institutionalized denial. Is there anyone in this room who doesn't recognize what I'm talking about? Anyone who doesn't see this in their own life? There isn't. I guess they're well suited for this message, but that doesn't mean they like to hear it. So, in Jessica, we see malaise spreading like a cancer into all areas of her life. Her carefully constructed life is now in a cascade failure. Her career shows her that healthcare is a bureaucratic, systemized farce, her words. Her relationships open her eyes to the fact that no one else can bring meaning into her life. Her successes now appear to her as failures. She says, I was becoming soul sick, and I saw no way out of it. No way out. That's the core of this experience. You're trapped. Can't go back. Can't go forward. Can't stay where you are. What we're seeing here is the end of the line, literally. I tap the whiteboard at the point where the mass of men line becomes the event line. This is where the denial stops working and all pretense melts like wax. I pause to study the letter and to give everyone a moment to connect what I'm saying with their own experience. So, here she is, I say, sliding inexorably down that mass of men line. Denial is the only thing that keeps any of us from doing the same thing. But for Jessica, denial has run out. She's sliding toward that drop-off I've labeled event.
We all are, of course, but she's there now. So what do you think happens? What's the event?
I hold up the letter. It's obviously not death.
Everyone is staring at the board as if the answer is there.
She finds Jesus? Asks someone in the back. Several people laugh.
Good guess, I reply. What does born again mean except death and rebirth?
People come to a crisis in their lives where they feel trapped and hopeless, and their egoic limitations are destroyed. A genuine born-again experience would certainly qualify as an event. But that's not what happens here.
Not all born-again events are genuine? Someone asks.
No, most are just a desperate redoubling of denial rather than release.
Anyone else want to guess what Jessica's event was?
No one else guesses. I read it straight from the letter.
I was in a car accident, and my neck was broken.
Several people make pained sounds. Everyone looks adequately uncomfortable. No one seems bored. I hold up her letter.
She says she knew that something like this car accident was coming weeks in advance. She didn't know that she'd survive, but she knew that some sort of resolution had to occur, and that it would have to be catastrophic in nature.
I look through the letter for something I'd underlined.
In every way, it was perfect, I read. That's what she says about the accident. You see how she's operating on a different level now? She's in a place where she can see a car accident and a broken neck as perfect.
I read the entire passage.
In every way, it was perfect. I've always thought of it as a perfect transition, even before I had the benefit of time and perspective to consider its meaning.
I can see that everyone is fully attentive. Jessica is a real person, just like any of them. She's not a myth or a legend or a movie star on a 50-foot screen. She's just a regular person, confronting her life honestly.
The first time I read this letter, I continue, I thought it was quite extraordinary that she was able to appreciate the larger picture even while she was in the midst of this catastrophic event. But it gets better. Try to appreciate her circumstances. She's in this prolonged, deepening depression about the futility of her existence when she gets slammed by a drunk driver. Emergency crews extricate her from her crumpled vehicle. Ambulance ride. Her clothes cut away in a frenzied emergency room. X-rays waiting, head taped down, her body completely immobilized. No idea of her condition. Eventually, two doctors come to explain her situation to her, the possibility of permanent paralysis or death. They tell her that her neck is broken and that they need her consent so they can operate immediately.
It doesn't get much heavier than that, right?
And what does she tell them?
I walk to the whiteboard and point to the word spirit to the right of the vertical dotted line.
She tells them no.
I let that hang in the air.
I want them to think about that, to wonder what it means, to wonder why she said it. I want them to think about how their own lives would have to change in order for them to appreciate the perfection of a broken neck and to reject the advice of medical experts trying to save them from paralysis and death. I want them to see for themselves that there is such a thing as life beyond fear.
The doctors are very insistent, even intimidating. They try to bully her into agreeing to surgery, but she doesn't budge. A 24-year-old girl strapped to a gurney in a state of calm lucidity. Everything is on the line. Medical experts are giving her advice anyone would leap at. See, it's not just that vertical drop of the death experience. It's also the phoenix-like ascent out of the ashes, the birth of the new being into a new world, a different world where different rules apply. You'll find this exact transition in every version of the hero's journey, because this is the heart of it. Curtis, in the first Star Wars movie, do you remember where Luke makes this transition?
He trusts the Force, answers Curtis.
Exactly. Flying through those canyons of the Death Star, everything on the line, total success or total failure in the balance, he switches off his navigational computers, panicking his experts, as I recall, and chooses to rely entirely on the Force. That's the transition. The old way is fully exited, and the new way is fully entered, not by word, but by deed, when it matters most, when everything is on the line. Everyone looks sharply attentive. The only drama more engrossing than the hero's journey is the hero's journey with you as the hero. And that's what I think these folks are thinking about. Not in a rah-rah, sounds great, let's go do it sense, but in a holy shit sense. They're trapped, just like Jessica was. They know they're trapped, and they know, at the little bastard level, that their life, their self, is all a fabrication created to shield them against this plain truth. It's not about being the hero of your people, but of your own life. Think of what Jessica's life must have been like before the event, before the onset of her profound disenchantment. She must have been a strong, forceful person, accustomed to carving her way through the world, willful, self-determined, someone we'd all respect. Then, after the event, she lets go. Unconditional surrender. Not mine, but thy will be done. Brahma is the charioteer. She releases the tiller and lets the ship of her life find its own course, calm in the understanding that it will sink or sail. Either way, resolution. Anytime I talk about interesting stuff, I have to wonder how it's being received. It looks like I'm talking to people, but what I'm really trying to do is get past the ego to the little bastard in each of them. That's the challenge. That's what makes it interesting. Can these people be looking at this diagram and listening to Jessica's story and not be spurred to a higher level of awakeness by it? Probably not. But my guess is that they'll experience a few solemn hours of serious reflection before allowing themselves to get swept back into the distracting minutiae of their lives. Their little bastards might try to reawaken them to this later on, but by then, ego will have seized upon it like white blood cells swarming an invasive microbe that threatens the organism. And tonight's penetrating insights will be tomorrow's mildly interesting spiritual anecdote. I indicate the sharply angled upward line. This is a second childhood. This is where she learns what she is and how she relates to her surroundings, just like a child discovering herself and her world. Is she paralyzed? No. She wore something called a halo. She calls it a stabilizing mechanical contraption for months. But even now, a dozen years later, her road to recovery continues. This causes some sympathetic groans. You remember that in her massive men days, she entered the healthcare profession. She had an urge to help people, to heal, but found that the course she had chosen didn't fulfill this desire. Some of you might be familiar with shamanism, with the ordeal a person undergoes to become a shaman, and the way that the shaman is henceforth set apart from the tribe. Again, I indicate the line behind me. There are no shamans on the mass of men line. This whole thing she's going through is her process of becoming a shaman, a true healer. She doesn't get to be a healer because the gods bestow powers upon her,
but through the prolonged, rigorous, all-consuming struggle of her own self-healing. See what I mean? You don't teleport up the mountain. You climb. Becoming a shaman, an authentic healer, invariably entails a mortal crisis, a break from the old ways and rebirth into new ways. This is what happened with Jessica. Through years of effort and struggle to regain her former health and stamina, she became a true healer. True, as opposed to that system of health care that she found to be a bureaucratic nightmare, as opposed to those doctors she rejected and the approach to health they represented. I don't think anyone here will have too much trouble seeing that our modern health care system is not one of genuine healers. The group responds with nods and murmurs of assent. I point to the last segment of line. Life. Here's where Jessica's real education began. Not an education of books and lectures, but of her own body, her own life. She had to learn a new way of living and of learning. Over the next decade, she worked with many types of healers. I refer to the letter. Chiropractors, osteopaths, myotherapists, craniosacral therapists, acupuncturists, many kinds of energy healers, many neuromuscular therapists, therapeutic yoga practitioners, neo-shamans, homeopaths, and many more. I knew that my healing was my responsibility, my process. I traveled all over the country, and in every situation, I was a participant and a student, not just a patient. I took what I needed from each and moved on, following my inner guidance rather than prescribed courses of treatment and deepening my powers of intuitive awareness. I learned about energy and emotion, that body, mind, and spirit are not three things, but one. My free-form course of treatment worked superbly, as I always seemed to move effortlessly into just the right thing at just the right time. My healing went far beyond recovering from the accident. I was able to correct many problems and rid myself of many physical and emotional toxins I was harboring, so that my health is probably closer to perfect now than it's been since I was a small child, maybe ever. I point to the lifeline and draw a red circle around the arrow at the end of it. There is no final destination, I say. Her journey continues to this day. Now she's a genuine healer. Her practice has clients all over the world. Her journey has brought her to this place of mastery and service and growth, and even now that journey continues. She says she realized that her own healing was her own responsibility, and that's a huge step for anyone to take. We might equate surrender with abdication of self-responsibility, but it's really just the opposite. It's where we dispense with intermediaries like priests and doctors and government and take our own lives into our own hands. She says in the letter, "My accident might seem like one of the worst things that can happen, but for me, it was the best thing, and I look back on it with a gratitude that is beyond any words to describe. I look back over my life, and there's nothing I would change. I am truly blessed." Afterward, I'm on the steps in front of the church again. Most everyone has gone. I'm busy writing down notes from the evening, my habit after most dialogues. Curtis has gone to get the Jeep. Megan passes without noticing me. "Megan," I say, "got a minute?" "Oh, hi," she says. "Yes, of course." I thought more about what you asked in the PR meeting, the living in the moment business. "Oh," she says warily, "you did?" "You know what it sounds like to me? I'm just going to share an opinion with you. I'm not saying I'm right or anything, But I do want to say first that what I'm about to say isn't meant in any flippant or disrespectful way. I actually mean it in a very respectful way. Well, respectful to dogs, anyway. To dogs, she says, her tone making me wish I'd just left this alone. But I wanted to try this out on her and see how it played. Yeah, this probably sounds, well, I don't know how it sounds, but the way I figure it, dogs are the most advanced beings on the planet. They're fully self-realized. They possess unconditional love. They forgive instantly. They're empathetic and sympathetic. They're incapable of guile or dishonesty. They're always in the moment, not carrying the past or fretting about the future. Everything's always new and wonderful. Every place is always the best place to be. I'm not getting any response, so I continue. I say they're the most advanced beings, and I mean that by our standards, human standards. If you think about the qualities you'd like to possess, the ideal qualities, unconditional love, loyalty, devotion, unwavering friendship, forgiveness, selflessness, sincerity, being fully present in the moment, happiness, qualities we uphold as the loftiest ideals to which we might aspire. They look very much like, you know, a good dog, dog consciousness. Of course, I add, by these same ideal standards, humans are far and away the least evolved beings on the planet. She smirks at that. A good sign. So anyway, that's what your comments made me think of. Do dogs have Buddha nature? Dogs are Buddha nature. We don't need books and teachers and philosophies. If you want to learn from a great spiritual master, get a dog. They're the real Zen masters. Like I say, I don't want to offend you. I really mean this in the most... She puts a hand on my arm, and I gratefully shut up. She's a dog person, she tells me. She understands. She has a cavalier King Charles Spaniel, her close companion for more than a decade, who is currently near the end of his life. She already knows that what I'm saying is true, she says, but she'd never made the connection. Once I started saying it, she saw it right away. We sit on the steps together for the next hour and share happy and sad stories about the enlightened beings we have known. End of Disc 7.